the title of the class is called Law and Order, but it's a misnomer. The real title of the class is Meaning in Mitzvot. We're going through all the mitzvot as they appear in the Torah according to the counting of the Sefer HaChinuch. It just happens to be that we're in Parshat Mishpatim, which is primarily laws that have to do with the legal system. And since we're dealing with the legal system, we call it Law and Order, but it's really part of a larger vision. We're at mitzvot number 76, 77, and 78 that deals with the laws of majority. We've actually spoken about number 78 a little bit before. If you remember when we spoke about the laws of appointing a king, I raised the question of what is the ideal form of government for the Jewish state? And we spoke a little bit about how during the 1930s and 40s and 50s, there were many rabbis, Rav Kook and Rav Yisraeli, Rav Herzog, who was the chief rabbi, who wrote how Judaism and democracy are compatible, and it's good that the state of Israel is going to be a democracy. One of the arguments they used, however, was not mitzvah number 78, which is a surprise. Mitzvah number 78, if you look at the very top, it's a mitzvah hatia acharei rabim, lintot acharei rabim, that you should be inclined after the majority. You shall follow the majority. In other words, majority rules. There's many different ways you can make a decision on any type of issue. I'm in a class at Hebrew University, and of course the thing that people fight most about in the class is the air conditioner. It's the same thing, of course, in shuls around the world. Everyone fights over the air conditioner. So our teacher takes a vote, usually in the middle of a class, of who wants the air conditioner on and who wants the air conditioner off. But he says it's too simple just to say who wants it on, who wants it off. That's not really descriptive enough. So you have to raise your fingers from 1 to 10. 10 being, I feel strongly, the most strong about this position, and 1 the least strongly. So what he ends up doing is people raise their hands, and there's a group of people who wants it on, and you put 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, and then other people put up. That's a different form of voting. It also has an element of majority, but it also recognizes the degree of interest and strength in your particular opinion. There's many different ways of making a decision. You could simply defer to whoever is the oldest in the room, whoever is the youngest in the room, whoever is the neediest in the room, right? There's many different ways of making a decision. That we follow the majority seems to be sort of one of the most acceptable ways, but it's not necessarily a guarantee, but the Torah does introduce it as an important concept, but it's not used as the argument of why we should have democracy in the state of Israel. And the question is why? And you see that from the Sefer HaChinuch in the very beginning. If you want to follow along in English, the commandment of inclining towards the many, to incline towards the many, that is when there arises a disagreement among the sages and a law of all the Torah laws. Let's say there are judges in a city. Some say the person is guilty. Some say the person is innocent. You follow the majority, as it's stated in the Torah, in Exodus, in Sefer Mishpatim, Parshat Mishpatim, to incline towards the many. And this choice of majority appears to be when two opposing groups are equally known for their Torah wisdom. So you get a sense already why the Sefer Chinuch does not think this applies to the establishment of a state. First of all, we've already seen that there's a mitzvah of a king. We could talk about that again sometime in the future. But why is democracy, or why is majority rules not the basis? Why is this particular mitzvah not the basis of establishing a state? First of all, he's talking about judges. Right? It's clear that this is describing the judges. So in other words, this could be an argument for judicial democracy, judicial majority. If you're sitting around a court, you know, the court rules 5-4, you follow that decision. But not a legislative majority, right? You have groups of, in the United States, you have 435 representatives, 100 senators, majority carries the way. This is not an argument for that. It's only an argument for the judges. And it's an argument, it's not an argument of the people. It's an argument of elitism, in fact, right? Because it says only if you're of a certain level of Torah knowledge, of Torah wisdom. The requirements to be a judge were actually quite sophisticated. If you look on the back, let's see if I did this somewhat correctly. I did not do it at all correctly. I apologize. If you look at... I didn't number it, so I really have done you a disservice. It's at the very top of one of the pages that says, Mishnah Torah, Hilchot Sanhedrin, Chapter 2, Halachot 1 and 3. It's also 7 and 8 are also included there. Okay? So you'll see that the judges who are appointed, which is who the Sefer Chinuch is referring to, are elitists. We appoint to the Sanhedrin, both to the Supreme Sanhedrin as well as Minor Sanhedrin, only men of wisdom and understanding, of unique distinction in their knowledge of the Torah, possess a broad intellectual potential. They should also have some knowledge concerning other intellectual disciplines, medicine, mathematics, the calendar, astronomy, astrology. By the way, I should also mention that the judges used to have additional languages because it's a requirement when courts would hear, they had to hear testimony in the language they understood. And so most judges knew many languages, but there was at least two judges on the Sanhedrin who knew every language. Therefore, if a witness came and spoke in a foreign language, there were at least two judges who could hear it, and then they would give testimony on what they heard directly in the language that they understood. So these judges were very sophisticated individuals. There are other requirements. I just put this so you have, it will come back to in a little bit. We should not appoint to a Sanhedrin a man of very old age or one who is a saris. Saris is someone like an inah who can't have children, for they possess the trait of cruelty. It's a little bit of a surprise why he says that. Or a man who is childless, so that the judges should be merciful. Why does the Rambam write that? So with regards to a very old person, it's interesting what he says. That's in the Hebrew, V'tam ha'askarut v'zaken. Why is an old person cruel? Not that they're cruel. Sheshecha kvar tza'ar yidu banim. He's already forgotten the difficulties of raising children. And apparently when you're in the world of raising children, you may have a little bit more patience because you know that people are crazy, right? You have these kids, and these kids are crazy, and it's developed a certain sense of patience, I would say. And once you've left that behind, I feel it myself, by the way. We have a daughter who's 20 years old. I thought I was done with child rearing, and now I have a two-year-old. And I will tell you that I am much less prepared, or I remember things now that I did not expect with this two-year-old that I remember when I was 20-year-old. So the main concern, however, is not per se the individual characteristics, but there should be an element of appreciation and mercy where people are coming from. And certainly the idea of having children, I think for those who have had, know that it does teach a certain amount of additional mercy. My two-year-old woke me up four times yesterday in the middle of the night. I remember that when I was in college, if someone woke me up four times, by the way, one of the times he woke me up, I was actually laying with him. He had urinated through his diaper all over the bed that I was on. If someone had done that to me in college, I would be very upset at 3 in the morning. The fact that my two-year-old did it to me, I had nothing but, you know, mercy for him. So perhaps that's part of what's going on. We continue on. We are not careful to demand that a judge for a court of three possesses all these qualities. In other words, these are strong suggestions. Person doesn't have to have all these qualities, but he should have some combination that makes him special in this regard. But he should have 7 basic attributes: wisdom, humility, the fear of God, a loathing for money, a love for truth. He must be beloved by people at large, and he must have a good reputation. All these are explicit in the Torah, and the Rambam actually gives the sources from where they are. I'll come back to the last requirement in a moment. But I do want to just return now to that first page because we see that the Sefer Chinuch is not talking about democracy per se, but sort of a aristocracy, I would even suggest, an elitism. And indeed, that is the opinion of some of what is the ideal form of government. The Abarbanel, for example, he sort of thought the Italian republics of the Middle Ages were the ideal form of government that was led by sort of a group of noblemen and aristocrats who had the best interests of the whole city. And the Abarbanel felt that we have sort of an academic nobleman, the sages, that they should lead the country, and it's a democracy between them, but not amongst all the common people. And of course, not only the Sefer Chinuch feels that way in the Abarbanel, but the many political philosophers felt the same issue as well. If you see John Stuart Mill on Liberty, his book, he writes about what is the problem of majority rule in a, not in an elite not in the courts, but in the legislature. He says, the problem is as follows. It was now perceived that such phrases as self-government and the power of the people over themselves, which sounds wonderful, do not express the true state of the case, of the reality. The people who exercise the power are not always the same people with whom those power is exercised. Self-government is not always you governing yourself, but rather it's followed by the majority. It's the government each by all of the rest, meaning if 51% of the people, that's the majority, wants to do X, they impose their values on the 49%. That means a great number of people are not self-governing. In fact, the opposite. This is what he goes down and calls the tyranny of the majority. And this is what gave rise to constitutions that says, in principle, we follow the majority, but the majority cannot violate certain fundamental basic rights of the minority. Otherwise, you have the tyranny of the majority. So there is a great concern with majority. The majority can diminish the rights of a great number of people. And so perhaps that's why the Sefer Chinuch was not talking about it for a country, but in the courts, he did feel that it was appropriate. Edmund Burke introduces this concept of trustee democracy. He was elected, I think, from Bristol in Great Britain. And as soon as he was elected, and a lot of his campaign was funded by many of the wealthy merchants. It was a seafaring area in England. And he was elected, and as soon as he was elected, he wrote a paper because some of the merchants came to him and said, we want you to put forth a certain legislation that will benefit us. You're representing us. We want you to put that forth in Parliament. And he wrote a lengthy letter that's become quite famous where he says that's not what a representative is about. A representative is supposed to give his best judgment of what's best for the country, not to represent the specific interests of the people who elected him. You can imagine they felt that was a little bit of a bait and switch. But it's an interesting debate about democracy. How do you view democracy? Do you view it that the person you elect should represent your interests? Or are you voting on that person because you trust them to make the best decisions for the country? And there's arguments on both sides. You know, if everyone's voting in their exact interests, you could have a lot of waste, right? This happens in Israel a lot. There are a number of parties, their whole interest is we don't care what anyone else is going on. We only want to try to make sure to get as big a budget for our particular population. You also have in Israel ideological parties. They make no promise to you as an individual whatsoever. I'm not going to help you with taxes. I'm not going to help you with, but I'm going to help if you believe in a certain value. And so you have this debate in many democracies. Yeah, so that's what Edmund Burke writes against. You're actually describing a third group amongst the legislators that they're willing to make compromises in order to accomplish what they want. But very often you're absolutely right that money plays a big role. So Burke says, even though you bankrolled me and I'm representing you and I know that you'll vote me out if I don't do your interest, I'm not going to do your interest because in this instance, I don't think you're following what's best for the country. It's a very powerful statement that he made, and perhaps why we remember him more as a philosopher than as a politician, because he didn't last too long as a politician, but his philosophy does remain. So if you see what he wrote, he says his job is to give his unbiased opinion, not to sell it to the highest bidder. His mature judgment, his enlightened conscience, he ought not sacrifice to you, to any man. He's writing to the people who elected him, or to any set of men living. Your representative owes you not his industry, meaning his efforts, but his judgment, and he betrays instead of serving you if he sacrifices it to your opinion. Right? He says, the way I represent you is I represent my truth. And we're going to come back to that because the Sefer Chinuch says something like that, something very similar to that a little bit later. A trustee considers an issue, and after hearing all the sides of the debate, he exercises their own judgment in making decisions about what should be done. You choose a member indeed, but when you have chosen him, he is not a member of Bristol, he's a member of Parliament. Right? Any of people familiar with trusts in a state, that's what a trustee is as well. Trustee has to follow what does it say is the interest of the trust without being influenced by the outside. Okay, so we see that there are challenges with democracy. Nevertheless, or majority rule, nevertheless, the Sefer Chinuch says, in the world of courts, it makes a lot of sense. What is the argument to follow majority? If we see that there could be majority rule is not always, could punish the minority. If you have a 5-4, right, it punishes them. But he says it's still valuable to have the majority. It's not always fair. It's not always, so what's the argument to have majority nevertheless? So I think there's about three different major themes of arguments. One of them, and now I'm talking about even just regular secular writing, but we'll see it in the Sefer Chinuch as well, is that the first argument is that majority usually is the fairest way. Everyone is heard. You don't always win, right? If you lose an election, but you got to vote, the system is fair. And so therefore you're prepared to accept it even if you lose at the end of the day. That there's a certain equality when each person raises one hand, and that's how you make the determination, there's a certain equality in that, and that value is important. And I think the Sefer Chinuch says something like that, and certainly the way, if we look at the last Rambam, the last Rambam was, again, the page where Mishnah, Torah, Hilchot, Sanhedrin, chapter 2, Halachot 1 and 3 is at the top. The fourth paragraph, it starts, our sages, that's actually Halacha 8, I believe. It says, our sages relate. How were justices on the Sanhedrin chosen? Right? How do we get to the Sanhedrin? So, historically, there's a difference of opinion. Some say the king appointed. There's 71 people. The king would appoint the 71 justices on the Great Sanhedrin. Others say that perhaps it was the king in consultation with the other 70, the 71 judges who were already there. Or maybe not the, others say it's not just the king. Those 71 sort of self-appointed, when there was an opening, they would decide amongst themselves. Again, it's sort of an elitist way of picking, to making sure that they always got the best quality. And how do you get the first 71? So the first 71 was from Moshe Rabbeinu. He said, pick 70 elders. You'll be the 71st. And what Moshe decided to do to create a sense of equality is what he did is he picked the 12 tribes, and he asked each of the 12 tribes to pick the 6 greatest scholars in each of your tribes. Some say Moshe picked the 6. But either way, you had 6 representatives. That creates one problem, however. 12 times 6 is 72. We're only allowed to have 70 because Moshe's the 71st. So 2 people were left out. What he did was he took a lottery. He wrote down, you know, you're on. He had 70 pieces of paper, and he had 72 people pick, and whoever didn't get on the Sanhedrin, they were left out. Anyone know who those 2 who were left out? Eldad and Medad. You know, when you talk about, they, it says they were prophesizing because they were great. They were Zkenim, but they missed getting picked to be on the original Sanhedrin. So that's how you got the original Sanhedrin, and from there, internally, they would choose further going on. What you see from this process, there's a certain element of equality because you had each of the tribes represented. Not every individual is equal, but each tribe is equal, despite some are larger and some are smaller. Each tribe is represented. And there's this idea that, therefore, everyone had a fair say, at least in principle, to what they wanted to do. Now, if you look at the Rambam now is describing how Sanhedrin was picked later, after this initial period of time, and you see there remains this element of equality, and I would also say this element of diversity, which we'll just talk about in a moment. Our sages relate. When the Supreme Sanhedrin, they would send emissaries throughout the entire land. They were always looking for new justices. They didn't just stay in Jerusalem. I'm on the top of the page where it says Mishnah Torah Hilchot Sanhedrin, chapter 2. You know what? If I want to make life easier for you, if you have a pen, page number 1 is at the top of the page, Mitzvot 76, 77, 78, majority rules. Page 2, it says Mishnah Torah at the top of the page, Hilchot Sanhedrin, chapter 2, Halachot 1 and 3. Page 3 is it's Are Told, thank you. And page 4 is Have Done. I apologize. I'll get the numbers next time. Okay. On page 2, the fourth paragraph, They would go out and they would look for judges. Whenever they found a person who was wise, sin-fearing, humble, meeting the seven requirements we had already spoken about, they have him appointed to a judge in his own city. From there, he would be promoted to the court, and then they would go to the Temple Mount, and from there, the Temple Mount court had 23. He would eventually get up to the Supreme Court. So you again had, from throughout the country, was represented, and so that's the first argument. The first argument of why majority works is that there's an element of equality. Everyone is represented, and then there's also an element, as I said before, of diversity. And from diversity, you also get deeper insights, because not just different people are represented, but different ideas are represented. And when you have a majority, you very often, therefore, have the greatest chance of accessing what is actually true. We have this in the whole concept of chavruta learning. Chavruta learning, I've said many times before, it's like two swords that are clashing at each other. And from that interaction between two swords, they both get sharper. From two people learning, they both get sharper as a result. And the Sefer Chinuch says exactly that. If you look on page 1 in the bold part of the first paragraph, when you have people of equal wisdom, with approximately equalism, the Torah informed us that many opinions will always conform to the truth more often than minority. Okay? If you have 10 people, 11 people that are discussing something, and 6 say this is the truth, and 5 say this is the truth, you're playing statistics. You might not always correct, but more often than not, having that diversity of opinion and the numbers represents most likely a more accurate answer. So that's what we call the epistemic argument of democracy, of argumentation, that there is a greater chance that this produces the right answer, that we're after truth and we get it. So now you have there's a value majority of equality, of fairness, and of truth. You also get an argument of efficiency. The Sefer Chinuch says, if you look at still on page 1, it is from the roots of the commandment that we were commanded through this to strengthen the fulfillment of our religion. As if we were commanded, the Torah says, keep the Torah according to how you understand it. Each and every one in Israel would say, it follows my opinion, the truth of the matter, X is such. And then everyone would be disagreeing with one another, and there would be complete chaos. And so there's an efficiency, there's an order, if we all agree on following one direction. And that one direction is determined, therefore, by majority. It's one of the easiest ways to do that. Democracy also has an additional advantage that people buy in, that if you include people in the decision-making process, your decisions are not only more accurate, but the people who are involved in decision-making are more likely to follow it. The fact that we, on some level, can vote for our representatives who create the laws, we feel more committed to the laws if they were simply handed down from on high. So there's a great deal of participation. There's a very deep point here about halacha in general. You know, I see Jews all the time walk around on the streets of Jerusalem with a Talmud in their hand. You will never see people, even lawyers, very seldom, walk around just reading the Constitution or reading law books, secular law books, because it's a totally different way of presenting law. In America, for example, the law is the law, and there's hundreds of law books. And if you need to know the law, you'd go to one of those law books. But you don't engage in the law. You're not like studying it on a daily. You're not trying to memorize those laws. It's there if you need to know it. But in Judaism, something different happens. We actually study the law. Like, what are we doing right now? We're trying to understand the law, but it's because we're engaged. We're invested in this entire process. When you're engaged, it's a part of who you are, and therefore you're more likely to follow it. And so therefore, the Sefer Chinuch says, it's not just because it produces truth that we want everyone involved, it also produces commitment and engagement. And I would like to suggest, and this is now on page 3, in the middle of the page, the Rabbeinu Nissim, he's going to argue that even when you don't get truth, this value of having order, of not having people fight, right, because we've agreed to follow the majority, and most importantly, of participation, that there's a religious element in this following the majority, because we are all involved in the process. That's perhaps the most significant element of following the majority. The Rabbeinu Nissim is from, I guess what today would be Barcelona. What, the Ron. That's page 2, yes. The Ron is most famous for his sort of halachic decisions and writings on the Rif, the Rabbeinu Al-Falsi, which is at the back of every Talmud. But the Ron also wrote 12 essays on politics that are incredibly fascinating, and they have great insights into even politics today. He also speaks about democracy, and we used him, the Ron, a lot. I think his fifth drasha, when we spoke about democracy and the concept of a king, and he explained the concept of a type of democracy connected to a king in that drasha. Here he's talking about something different. He's going to talk about participation as an important element of democracy, even if democracy doesn't produce truth. He believes democracy or majority rule more often than not, certainly majority rule amongst the elite more often than not, does produce truth, but even if it doesn't, that's not the highest concern. Our sages of blessed memory see this. He's now talking about the mitzvah of Kiddush HaKodesh, which was the fourth mitzvah that the Sefer HaKinik taught us. The Kiddush HaKodesh, if you remember, Kiddush HaKodesh is sanctifying the new moon. And one of the interesting halachot is, if the Beit Din says the new moon is such and such a day, even if it's found out that they were wrong, they heard testimony incorrectly, there was a cloud and they thought it was there and it wasn't there, even if they're wrong, we follow that law whenever they declare it. And he says, the more important, and it's not just him, everyone says this, the more important thing is that the Beit Din made the decision. And if you remember, the Rav Hirsch has a beautiful teaching. He connects and he says, Rosh Chodesh is called the Moed. Moed is an appointed time to meet. We call our holidays Moedim. They're not like Shabbat. Shabbat, God tells us every 7 days. That's it. A Moed is when people mutually agree to meet. Oel Moed is a place that we mutually agree to meet. God and Moshe. Moshe sets up a tent, God meets at that place. So our Moedim is a connection, a relationship between us and God deciding together. God tells us the general idea, but our Moedim, our holidays, are determined when we declare Rosh Chodesh. So he says, even if we're wrong, whatever the Beit Din says is the law. The Ron says, what are you supposed to learn from that? If you go to the third paragraph, he now talks about the Gemara and Chagiga a little bit, and he says in that paragraph that all the Torah was given at Har Sinai, Moshe heard it all, even the mistakes. Meaning even when people suggest this might be how the Torah should be interpreted, and they're rejected and they're wrong, that was also included. And he says, how could it possibly be that God shared with us the mistaken interpretations of the Torah at Har Sinai? He says, that doesn't seem to make sense. And now the fourth paragraph. Now this indeed is how it must be understood. How can it be said that both rulings in a halakhic dispute were stated by Moses, by the omnipotent, meaning God? Shammai says that there is a requirement of chala of a kav. Hillel says it begins from 2 kavim. These are just measurements. One of these can only be true. How can both of these be from the one God? So he says the understanding as follows. All of the Torah, both the written and the oral Torah, was given to Moshe at Har Sinai. And then he goes on to say that what I had said previously, that even the mistakes, even the arguments were included. The fourth line, the scribes' deductions are disputes and differences of view among Torah scholars. All of them were taught to Moshe. How do we understand this? This underlies the episode of Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol. This is the famous dispute. We now go to page 3. That Rabbi Yehoshua got up and he says, this is not in heaven. If you're familiar with the story, there's an argument between Rabbi Eleazar and Rabbi Yehoshua about the famous oven of Achnai. Is it pure or is it impure? And it's clear that the answer is with, oh, I'm sorry. He's giving a different example for that, but let me just now. Okay, Rabbi Eliezer clearly has the right answer, right? There's miracle after miracle is performed to say that he's correct. He says, if I'm right, let the walls of the Beit Midrash lean. If I'm right, let the water of this river go backwards. If I'm right, let a bat call, a voice from heaven come down, and these all happen, and they all say that he's right. Nevertheless, the majority votes against him, and the Torah therefore says you have to follow the majority, and we follow the wrong answer. Because the Torah left the heavens, it says it's not in the heavens, it was given to man to now create the halakha. So we now have an inaccurate interpretation of the Torah as the halakha. And this is where the Ron says something I think quite interesting. If you look at the last couple of lines of the unbolded part, since their judgment, the majority, inclined to unclean, though they knew that their consensus was at variance with the truth, they knew they were wrong. They did not wish to pronounce it clean. What is more, had they pronounced it clean, they would have been transgressing against their own reason. They had to follow what they thought was correct, even though they now knew from the outside that they're wrong. They had to follow how they interpreted Torah, which inclined to unclean, the decision having been relegated to the sages of the generations. And then this is what the Ron says. And because this mitzvah is the beginning of the Torah, he's now referring to the Kiddush HaChodesh, the sanctification of the new moon. Just as the root reward and punishment is herein intimated. For this, the mitzvah being the beginning of the Torah, it is fitting that there be alluded to the rational of the mitzvah. Don't worry about that for a moment. He says there's another time that's a beginning of the Torah. That's the Passover lamb, right? You'd kill the Passover lamb and you'd put the blood on the doors and they were saved. And that's against nature, right? That's against nature. That in theory, everyone should have died. But somehow doing this mitzvah, doing this halakha, saves their lives. So what is the intent of all this? All this is to enforce the belief that the keeper of the mitzvot is above nature and not subservient to the galaxy and its forces. We are not bound by the laws of nature, right? That's how our lives were saved at Pesach, and that's how we are not bound by what the objective reality of when the new moon is. It's not the objective reality, it's what the sages say the reality is. This is what the intent of Moed Katan is when it says, I rule man, meaning God says, I rule man, and who rules me? God asks in the Gemara, who could possibly rule me? God, is anyone above God? And the Gemara says something radical. The righteous man, for I make a decree, and he annuls it. In other words, human beings are able to change what God says. It's an incredibly radical, powerful point that I have not made man subservient to nature. I have made man a partner with me in creation. And that's perhaps why it's so important to follow the majority. Even when the majority is wrong, we nevertheless do it because we want to introduce this concept and the importance of human endeavor. Okay. So these are just a few of the different values of why majority rule in a court makes sense. However, some of them don't make sense. Let's leave the world of Jewish courts for a moment. Let's go to a Supreme Court decision in the U.S. By a majority of 5-4, abortion is now allowed in the United States. And you know what? Tomorrow it could change. And death penalties are decided very often by a majority of 5-4. Sometimes not even everyone votes, and it's 4-3. So that means a person's life hangs in the balance of one vote. So everything we said about majority rule, you can begin to question a little bit. If you're the person who's put to death, do you feel like that's such a, do you have faith in the process? Because it's a majority, at least I got my voice heard, there were people who were supporting me. Not really, because it's so close. You feel like it could have just as easily gone the other way. And the same concept of equality. All of a sudden, you're giving one person a much more outsized role than everyone else. If he's one of 71, okay, everyone is equal. But when you're at 5-4 or something like that, you're giving much greater weight to that one person who tips the edges. So you don't necessarily have equality. You don't necessarily have fairness. You don't necessarily get truth either. Meaning, again, it's true over, if you had thousands of people, experts, let's say, vote on something, you get rid of all the variances. It's like when you do studies, you can't do a study just from, you know, 5 people. So 5-4, there's not a guarantee that really produces truth. If you had 5,000 to 4,000, the same ratio, that's more likely. But 5 to 4, it seems more problematic. And in fact, there are some people who have argued major decisions shouldn't be made by a 5-4 majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. And in fact, some states have changed it. For example, in Nebraska says if the court wants to overturn something that the legislator has passed a law, and if the court doesn't like that law, they shouldn't just be allowed to change it, because basically you're substituting your majority, a 5-4, to the majority of, right? You could have a 5-4 majority on a court that says this law is not legal, and that law could have been passed by, 534-1, and it's now not constitutional. So Nebraska says if you want to overturn a law, we have to require a greater majority than simply one, 5-4. They say we want 6-3. If we're going to change a law, we have a value of respecting the legislation, respecting the Constitution. Majority is important. We accept majority rule, but it can't trump this other value of respect of the legislature and the will of the people. This idea, by the way, is actually very much in Judaism as well, that we support the concept of majority rules, but there are some values that are too important simply to allow majority to rule, or at least a simple majority of one person. And that is the Sefer Chinuch Mitzvah number 76. So Mitzvah number 76, which is on page 3, right, it started with 78 that says the mitzvah of following the majority. Mitzvah 76 says, you don't follow the majority. Shalolim tot acharei rabim, bedinei nifashot. When it comes to a life or death issue, okay, if we're dealing with money, 5-4, fine. Or whatever the majority is, even by one, you follow it, no problem. It says, by the way, worst comes to worst. If you make a mistake, what do? You relitigate and you give the money back to the right person. But if you're dealing with life and death issues, and you put someone to death by only one vote, you can never correct that situation. And so therefore the Torah says, yes, you follow the majority, even if it's only one, but not when it comes to life and death matters. When it comes to life and death matters, you have to have more than a majority of one. So on the Sanhedrin, there's 23 people. The smaller Sanhedrin is 23 people. If the vote is 12-11, you do not put a person to death. You have to have 13-10. You have to have at least two people. And if you're stuck at 12-11, what they ended up doing is they would invite in two more people. And if they still were only one majority, they'd invite two more people. And they'd keep going all the way up until you had 71, until you had. And if you never get a majority of two, you can't put a person to death. You have to have a greater majority, kind of to a certain extent, like the Nebraska case, that they felt there are certain values that are more important than, even though we say majority produces truth and it has participation and all these other good things, there's other values that are even greater than that. And it seems to be, says the Sefer Chinuch, the greater value is mercy. That there has to be an element of mercy in our decisions, and we have to elevate that even above the importance of majority. So if you go to the Sefer Chinuch again, Mitzvah 76, let me just see. the learning is the continuation of the Torah. Again, everything the Sefer Chinuch does, he has to find a verse in the Torah. So he found the verse about following the majority. Here in Mitzvah 76, it says, if you look in the middle of the paragraph, you see in the parentheses, Exodus 23:2, it says, the Pasuk says, do not be after the many to do bad. And to be bad, to do bad is considered to put a person to death by a majority of one. Rather, you should do good. If you look at the last sentence, the Mechilta, the Rebbe Yishmael says, leaning to the good is according to one. But if you want to do something bad, if you want to put something to death, you need to do it according to two. Meaning we have a preference to try to find people innocent, not a preference to try to find people guilty. If you had to say there's a perspective that we should have, as justices, you should always try to find a person innocent. We have that in Pirkei Avot, Dan Makaf Skut, you always should try to do this. The source, the reason for this, it is from the roots of this commandment that we have been commanded to resemble the characteristics of God. This is something the Sefer Chinuch repeats again and again and again all the time. the main mission of a human being is to follow in the traits of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, right? In Matati Adeo, to follow how God behaves. God is merciful, we should be merciful. So our actions should be the same as God. Among his traits is that he is of great kindness. He's filled with mercy. He goes beyond the letter of the law. In Hebrew, we translate that as Litznei Mishur Adin. He goes beyond the letter of the law, and we are commanded to do this as well, that innocence be greater than liability in capital cases where there is no opportunity for payment. In general, in life, we should always try to find a schut, find a merit in a person, and don't simply say, well, the law says this, and leave it at that. You have to go more than that. The Bava Metzia, Gemara that I brought below, is where the concept of going beyond the letter of the law is introduced. It tells an actual humorous story in the beginning. Rabbi Shmuel, the son of Rabbi Yossi, he's an elderly man. He's walking in the forest, and there's a man who has collected some wood, and the man wants to bring that wood home and sell it. He can't lift it. So he turns to Rabbi Shmuel and says, can you help me lift this wood? Lifting this wood would be beneath the dignity of this elderly sage. You shouldn't have to bend down and lift it up and everything like that. So he asks the man, he says, how much is this wood worth for you? And the man says, a half a dinar. So Rabbi Shmuel says, okay, here's a half a dinar. I'm buying the wood from you, and now I'm leaving it here. Right? He wants the man to get his money. I'm leaving it here, and I'm saying it's hefker. It's ownerless. And then he begins to walk away. As he begins to walk away, the man says, oh, if the wood is ownerless, I'm going to acquire it, reacquire it. So he reacquires the wood that the man, that Rabbi Shmuel just bought. And he then turns to Rabbi Shmuel again and says, Rabbi Shmuel, can you help me lift up the wood? Rabbi Shmuel just paid him, so he didn't have to lift up the wood. He gives him another half a dinar. And the man says, okay. And Rabbi Shmuel says, this wood is hefker. No one owns it. You can imagine how the story goes. It's like a chassid story. The man says, I'm reacquiring it. Can you help me? Anyway, this goes on for however long you want it to go on. Rabbi Shmuel says, I make this wood hefker, meaning ownerless, to everyone in the world except for you. You can't own it. And then there's a whole discussion in the Gemara. It says whether or not you're allowed to do that or not. And they say at the end, Rabbi Shmuel is not allowed to do it, but what he was trying to do was just discourage the man from keep doing it. And so the Gemara then comes and says, wait a second. It was beneath Rabbi Shmuel's dignity. He was exempt. He didn't have to help the person. You don't have to help. Listen, if you can help a person, you can. But he didn't have to help the person. So why did he even decide to pay at all? And the end of the Gemara says, if you look, well, 2, 4, 6 lines up from the bottom. Why did he purchase the wood and render it ownerless in order to absolve himself of the obligation to lift the burden if he had no obligation to do it in the first place? The Gemara answers, in the case of Rabbi Shmuel, the son of Rabbi Yosei, he conducted himself beyond the letter of the law. He could have refused to help, but you should always try to help. And this is what he was, in fact, doing. And they learned this phrase, this source. There's a pasuk that says, you must do and you must perform. The you must do is you must follow the law. And the you must perform is you must go beyond the letter of the law. So we have this concept. In this case, beyond the letter of law is all about mercy. Mitzvah 77, which is on page 4, okay? Sefer Chinuch Mitzvah number 77. The main verse that we've been dealing with, you shall follow the will of the majority, except don't do the majority for bad, right? You only do it for good. Also has a phrase you should not follow the majority to incline in a dispute. Mitzvah number 77 learns a whole series of leniencies to make sure that you don't convict the person of murder, and you get them off the hook. Okay, Mitzvah 77 has all these different leniencies in order to try to solve the problem. So you see the Hebrew, it says, Shalo yilmad chova, you try not to find a person guilty. Mishalamad tzchut, you find all, and he lists all these different things. For example, if a person starts off and believing the person is innocent, he shouldn't change his mind. Okay, he can change it later in the dispute, but he should do his best not to change his mind. A couple other examples that exist. It says that a person who is the most senior rabbi in the Sanhedrin, would always speak last. Right? You don't want him influencing everyone else. They actually have the same law. It's interesting. Canadian Supreme Court, the youngest justices have to start speaking first, and the senior only speaks at the very end, because you don't want the older to influence the younger. And hope in American law, it's different. In the American Supreme Court system, after they hear all the decisions, they begin their voting. Sometimes they discuss, sometimes they just vote, and the senior starts first. But in Jewish law, the senior goes last, because you don't want them to influence the others, because maybe the youngers will find a, maybe they won't know all the law, and maybe they'll find a schut. If someone who says he's innocent on the first time around, and then he passes away, you still count his vote, says mitzvah number 77, as an innocent vote. But if someone says he's guilty and then he passes away, you can't count that as a guilty. You have to bring in a new person and have them vote again. There's a whole series of these halachot. And if you look actually in the English, he says, of course, you can't have just one. You can't have a 5-4 majority to put someone to death. We don't allow that. Okay. He says, if you look at the fourth line down, where there's three dots, and the rest of the things that we learn from it, such as the one who advocated innocence may not advocate guilt, that we do not open with guilt, that we do not begin from the great one, all of this is out of pity of God may bless upon his creatures. It is metaphorically like a man who has pity on his children. As it's written in Devarim, children are you to the Lord your God. We're coming up to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. We ask God, view us as children. What does it mean, view us as children? So it means you have mercy on us. Here's by way of a parable. If a man fathered 100 children, and he built a city for them and placed them there, but saw that they would not survive in the community unless he decreed upon them that anyone who hits his neighbor would be punished with his money, and if he kills him, he shall be killed. Right? You can't just have no laws whatsoever. It's Lord of the Flies. It's chaos. So he says there have to be certain rules and laws. And one of them, one of his sons, got up and transgressed this decree, and he killed another. If he forgave him, behold, the community would be lost. Right? If he says, that's it, no problem, it's fine. So that means everyone will murder. There'll be too much murder going on and the community is destroyed, as fear would not stay upon the others. So there has to be this law. So what is there for him to do? He sees his child who he has pity on, but at the same token, he has to punish him. So he says, so what is there for him to do and not see the death of his second son? He would nonetheless seek any way he can to exempt him according to the law. If he can, that is best. But if it is impossible, he found no loophole whatsoever, then, in fact, he would command to kill him. So is to preserve the community for the others, and so it is in this matter. We have to follow the law, but if we find any possible loophole, and he lists, basically, mitzvah 76 and 77 are all these loopholes that we should always try to find an element of mercy in order to do this. What I'd like to... there's a couple other things I want to say, but I'm running out of time. Well, maybe you have time. You have, let's say, 10 minutes. You started 5 minutes late. So let me try to do this. Let me do this way. Let me give you one more example of halacha, of mercy, and that maybe ties everything together. If you look just below, the Mishnah Torah, we're back to the Mishnah Torah, Sanhedrin now, chapter 9. He says as follows, the Rambam. If the Sanhedrin opens a capital case with a unanimous guilty verdict, he is exempt. Listen to that for a moment. Right? The courts are there. There's 71, there's 23 people. All 23 say he's guilty. In that instance, the person is exempt. He's not punished. It's the exact opposite of what you would think. Right? In American law, you have to have a unanimous decision in order to put them... Here it says, if you have a unanimous decision, the person's exempt. Everybody says he's guilty. Everybody, the entire court. Unanimous is 23 to 0. So if it's 22 to 1, they put him to death. Right? You need just a majority of 2, remember, to put someone to death. If it's 22 to 1, you put him to death. If it's 23 to 0, you don't put him to death. It's a very shocking halacha. Death sentence. No, this is a death sentence. Well, there's a little bit of more of a discussion in that, but it's primarily here for this purpose. he is exempt until, the Rambam writes, until some merit is found, meaning until one person maybe finds a merit in this guy to acquit him, and then the second you get 22-1, then you can put him to death. Okay? So what is the Rambam trying to get at? How are we to understand this halakha? It's a very 23-0, you don't put him to death. So he probably learned this from the Gemara, which I brought to you right below. Amar Rav Kahana, Sanhedrin Sharu Kulam Lechova, a Sanhedrin that sees everyone as guilty, everyone sees him as guilty, Potrim, you exempt him. My Tama, what is the reason? Kavan de Gamiri Halanat Din, the Maved Leis Chuta Vahani Tu Lo Chazulei. There is this concept of Hanalat HaDin. You have to, the Sanhedrin, when they would make a decision, again, another one of these leniencies, when they would make a decision about a person, they had to think on it overnight. They were not allowed to person, they bring in the person, and let's say it was obvious that he was the one, the murderer. They could not make the decision that day that everyone's guilty, that he's guilty. They had to wait until the next day and then make the decision. Why that? Rashi says, if you wait the next day, you give enough time for maybe one of those 23 to change their mind. Maybe one of them would find a merit. So that's the halakha of Hanat al-Adin. You have to wait one day. If they voted 23-0 on the first day, they didn't follow this law. They didn't wait to the next day. And so therefore, they're disqualified because they didn't follow the rules. The Bavitcher Rebbe has a different answer altogether. He says punishment is a blessing, is a reward. How so? Well, we're coming up to Yom Kippur. We know that the concept of atonement sometimes requires some type of punishment. So he says, for example, if there's a dispute and someone owes someone else money, and he pays the money, when they walk out of the court, we look at both of them as if they're totally innocent people. Because he paid the money. You don't view him as guilty, and then he paid. Once he paid, that was his punishment, as it were. And now he's an innocent person. If someone did something wrong and they get the lashes, they're now totally innocent. It's not like in American law, so where the recidivism rate, right? A person can never lose the tag of having made a mistake. We believe in tshuva. Part of the tshuva in this instance is he pays the money, he listens to the court, great. Even with death, by the way, there are some cases, a person does tshuva, it's his death that redeems him. So he listens to the court, he's put to death, but now he gets an olam haba. The Lubavitcher Rebbe says there are certain instances where a person, even their death, does not mekaper, that does not atone for them. In fact, they don't deserve death. He gives the example, it's a very interesting halakha that I always struggled with until I saw this insight. We learned it once before, the Eidim Zomamim. An Eid Zomamim is someone who tries to, right, he's the aid, he's the witness who says, I saw this person murder so-and-so. And two witnesses come forward and they say, I saw this person. And they're lying. The murder took place in Jerusalem, and they were in Hawaii at the time. So there's no way they could have seen it. So what is the halacha? The halacha says, if you have not yet put to death this person who was accused of murder, those two are put to death. But if the person, the wrongly accused, is already put to death, on their words, these two witnesses aren't put to death. It's crazy. It's the exact opposite. They should be put to death if they killed someone. So what the Rebbe says here is, no. When you save their lives, the innocent person is before he's put to death, they're basically guilty of attempted murder, and their punishment is death. But that death is an atonement for them. When they actually kill the person, what they did is so wrong, there's no atonement for them. They don't deserve atonement whatsoever. And so therefore, they're not given. That's what he says the Rambam is actually saying. He's saying the Rambam, when he says as follows, it's 23-0, it's so obvious that he's guilty, he must be an absolute terrible person. But we say the obligation of the Sanhedrin is to find something positive in him, one way possible to remove him from, he's so guilty he doesn't even get death, now he gets death. I want to take the Rebbe's point in a slightly different direction. What I want to argue is that the role of the Sanhedrin is to actually see the good in every person. At the end, that's what God does. God sees, you know, when God looks at a person, because God sees everything, God sees all our flaws, but he also sees any good things we have. And then the goal, of course, is to sort of develop those good things that we have. So the role of the Sanhedrin is to do the exact same thing, is to see the good in everyone. Now, at the end of the day, it may not be enough to save this person's life, but they're obligated to at least find the merit. And if you sit down amongst 23 people, and there's not one person who can say one good thing about this individual, so then that whole Sanhedrin is disqualified, because they couldn't even find one good thing, positive thing to say about him. This, by the way, this possible insight maybe connects the two things that we've been talking a lot about. This conflict between truth, what is the reality, is the person guilty or not guilty, and mercy, right? Because there's always a conflict, right? It seems that there's always a conflict. But this kind of solves the conflict, because the truth is that every individual does have some good quality. And that's what a court system should be able to see. A court system that can't even see the good, even if at the end of the day they have to put the person to death. But if you can't even see it, so then that's not truth after all. So sometimes the best way to achieve an actual genuine truth is to actually have mercy and appreciation and of looking at the person, finding their qualities, and then making the decision, whatever the case may be. Anyway, that is the conclusion of these three mitzvot together.